All right. So, you know, as individuals, sometimes you get stuck in routines. And I think sometimes we get stuck in routines as groups as well. And that includes the group of oral historians. And once in a while, doesn't happen very often, but once in a while, I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm wondering, you know, why do I do oral history? And the way I'm doing oral history, is that the right way to do it? One of the things that I wondered about a number of years ago was, why do we only interview the generation of eyewitnesses, of the people who were there? If we're interested in memory, your memory doesn't stop with the eyewitnesses. It goes on to the next generations. And social psychologists in Germany have been doing really fantastic work since the 1970s, interviewing not just eyewitnesses to the Second World War and the Holocaust, both Jewish survivors and German perpetrators, but also their children and then eventually the grandchildren, to figure out, you know, how these different generations negotiate family memories of very difficult experiences. In one of the contributions to this reader, I sort of, you know, tried to figure out how this could work in oral history. And we interviewed a family here in Winnipeg. The woman was an immigrant from Germany. She had lived through the Third Reich and had both sort of personal experiences of victimization, but also, you know, at least bystander relatives, people who had benefited from Aryanization and so on. And then we interviewed one of her daughters and one of her granddaughters. They told us individually their own stories, but also the stories that they had heard from their mother or grandmother. And then we put them together around a table, and we asked them to talk about memories of the Nazi period in Germany, but also memories of immigration to Canada and so on. And that provided really a sort of a rich dialogue or a rich conversation that showed that memory is something that is not just transferred from the old generation to the new generation, but it's something that is continually renegotiated and it's continually updated depending on the individual needs, but also the family needs. I've been trying to push this at the Oral History Center as well as something to be included in various projects, and we've done that with projects on refugees, for example, where we found that many times the next generation doesn't know anything about their parents. The children of Salvadoran refugees, for example, really don't know what happened during the Civil War or how their parents were involved or why their parents decided to come to Canada or to leave El Salvador. The same with more recent refugees from Afghanistan. So it is interesting to see these breaks in memories and family tales and to see how the next generations try to make up these gaps in memory by filling in, by using, for example, popular culture, by drawing on films and books and so on, other stories to fill in family memory. But at the same time, it's also great to see how in these oral history projects, the different generations, and I think that's sort of what Christina talked about, how the different generations can use oral history as a means to talk about family memories in a more open way, where they can ask questions that they otherwise would not dare ask. So it's sort of a formal way of doing family interviews, of creating, reconstructing family narratives. So this sort of multi-generational interviewing is something that we've been emphasizing at the Oral History Center, and I think it's also part of the Landscapes of Injustice project, where it's important to see how do memories continue, how are they related within families and across generations. Another moment where I woke up at night and thought, why are we doing this way, or why is there so much concern, is that recently with what has been called the digital revolution, a number of oral historians have argued that the digital, or these new digital tools, allow us to disseminate the oral histories that we conduct in a more immediate way. You know, they argue that we have all of these oral histories that are archived, but no one ever accesses them. No one ever looks at them. Instead, we should be, you know, really disseminating this stuff right now. And I'm thinking that's true, and I'm very sympathetic to that. But at the same time, we've been doing oral history and archiving oral history only for about 70 years. There are some older projects that are archived, but as an archive, it, you know, we have memories of the last or narratives of the last 70 years. So it is interesting to see colleagues who are historians to be so impatient and not have the endurance to wait for generations to consider that eventually these histories, these oral histories, will be useful. And so in another piece in this reader, I'm trying to explain, in this case, to sociologists how to use archived oral histories. But the point that I'm making is that archived oral histories, even though they are very difficult to use because you often don't know a lot of the context of how oral histories were created, provide wonderful opportunities to explore once again how memories and narratives change over time. We can use, you know, oral histories that were conducted in the 1950s and 60s now to conduct studies on sort of longitudinal studies on memory and narrative. So again, for one of the projects that we did here, we wanted to find out about the experiences of post-war refugees, people who came after the Second World War from Europe. And we found a number of interviews that were conducted, particularly with Holocaust survivors, but also with Polish immigrants, refugees, that were conducted in the 1970s and 80s, in the early 1970s and 80s. And we were able to find some of the people who had given them their testimonies in the 1970s and re-interview them, so that we now have interviews from the 1970s and the 2010s that we can compare in terms of how do their stories change over time, how do their memories change over time. And then we also interviewed, again, the next two generations, the children, the grandchildren, to see how memories change and are negotiated across time, across generations. So we've been really pushing the archival aspect of oral history, which is a very traditional way of doing oral history. That's the way oral historians in the States in particular have always emphasized the process of oral history. But they are not just sources in themselves. They are wonderful opportunities to go back to the narrators, to interview children and grandchildren, to sort of see how memory and narrative changes over time. And I think more broadly, these concerns have led me to think more about oral history as a practice, not just as a research method, but as a social practice in society. And again, this is part of social phenomena that I've witnessed, and sometimes just sort of reading things. So, you know, one of the experiences that I've had in a number of interviews was that people go into interviews and they get stuck in telling a story that they really don't want to tell. They begin a story, but they then have to finish the story somehow by revealing things they didn't plan to reveal. So there are all kinds of concerns about peer pressure. And I came across a short passage by Michel Foucault in his History of Sexuality where he talks about confession and the way in which confession, the practice of confession, was introduced and eventually became secularized in medical discourse and in especially psychoanalytic discourse. And I see much of that in popular culture today, where there seems to be a new way of redefining oral history as a or more broadly storytelling as a form of therapeutic talk, where telling your story means that you will become better. And not only that, because we know about this from psychoanalysis, but in psychoanalysis this stays in the room of the therapist. But nowadays it seems that a lot of this confessional talk needs to be public, and it needs to be public on the largest scale possible, the internet, to have really healing power. And so I've been thinking about, how does oral history as a practice fit into the sort of the long durée history of confessional practices? But also, how does oral history fit into this new, larger social phenomenon of, what you could call storytelling? Not the sort of the traditional practices of storytelling, but the whole industry of storytelling that we now have, especially in North America, but elsewhere as well, where telling a story, and especially about a personal confessional story, is seen as a means to solve all kinds of personal and public problems. In management, storytelling has been employed as a strategy to explain layoffs to workers. So instead of, making sure that they have decent jobs, they, invest copious amounts of money into storytelling, of telling them a story and training laid-off people how to, tell their own story to make sense of their layoff. There are all kinds of ways in which management theory has started to use storytelling as a means to improve advertising, promotion, management, interpersonal skills. There's all kinds of talk in terms of storytelling in the law, in the medical profession, where just telling your story is seen as a remedy, without ever talking about some of the more problematic implications of making your story public, of thinking about the ethics and the long-term implications of putting your most intimate personal details up online, and especially in the case of StoryCorps, of including all kinds of stories about minors on the website and making that public. And finally, and that is something that I'm working on now, oral history, and again, it's sort of something that comes out of working here at the Oral History Center and being concerned with archiving and filing and metadata and making these personal stories accessible to other researchers. We use in oral history very powerful tools. The filing cabinet and the archive are very powerful tools that are great for historians, but they are also used by the state for the surveillance of populations. So we are creating archives with very personal data, very personal information, and increasingly we are putting this stuff up online, or at least we are putting it on computers that are accessible by all kinds of surveillance technologies and institutions. So what are sort of the implications for us as oral historians? To what degree are we able to use oral history as a liberatory pedagogy, but to what degree are we implied in the increasing surveillance of populations by the state and increasingly by corporations? So those are sort of some of the concerns that I'm working on right now. All right, and now we have an hour to talk about all of this. So, questions.